good day wherever you may be, and welcome to Observations. I was observing the news feeds out of Washington today, and I thought one was particularly intriguing. The Trumpster has been trumping torture for the last week, something that I vehemently oppose, something the United States Constitution is opposed to, something that makes us, if when we did it, and that was something promoted during George W. Bush by himself, Condoleezza Rice, and Dick Cheney, when you do that kind of thing, it lowers a nation to the same level as the worst of humanity. And it's stunning to me that we, as a nation, didn't prosecute Bush or Cheney or Condoleezza Rice for authorizing torture.
And it doesn't work.
Oh, of course, it never has worked. It never will work. And even if it were to work, there are things you just do not do because they are evil.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say that torture worked 100% of the time. You still should not torture people. It's immoral. You know, last time I've checked that a gun pointed at a person's head will work the majority of times in achieving the desired result. But you ought not do it.
No. There's a line in the sand, you don't crawl.
Right, yeah, if you're trying to get drunk, drinking alcohol will achieve that goal. It works, but you ought not do it to excess.
No.
Just, you know, because something, even though, yes, torture does not work, but the fact of the matter is that you ought not do certain things, even if they did work. But this is what I found interesting. Isn't the President of the United States Commander-in-Chief?
Of the Army, yes.
Military, yeah. You know, what he finally said on torture after promoting it one more time today is he's going to defer on torture to the Secretary of Defense.
I don't think you can defer.
Has he not read the U.S. Constitution?
Hmm.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I just absolutely.
Isn't Mattis on record, though, saying that it doesn't work?
You know, yes, as is everybody that is the least bit informed and sane. But you know, even like the John McCain, who probably thinks it does work, John McCain is even, and I can't stand John McCain, but John McCain has come out and says, you know, we're not going back there. We're just not going to do that. Oh, it's, how do you ever even pretend to have the high moral ground when you advocate something like that? I'm flabbergasted. Speaking of flabbergasted, the a video of our program last week was posted by Steve. He posts many of them, and there was this fellow kind of looked like a rabbi. His name is Nathan Yahu Yisrael, and he was saying, you know, at least he knows that that Hashem isn't, he was talking about you and I and the likes of us, that Hashem isn't Allah or Buddha or Jesus or something else. But then he wrote, Yod Hey Wah Hey, you fill in the vowels.
Yeah.
And you want to tap the guy nicely on the forehead and say, what is the matter with you? All four letters are vowels. Did you not read the part where he said that his name was based on the verb Haya? Did you not look at how you wrote your own name? You wrote your own name as Nathan Yahu. How'd you get that pronunciation?
Some gift he is.
Yeah, I mean, have you never considered how do you pronounce the word Torah? Or Shalom? Have you never even considered these things? And it's... Oh, you just take a deep breath and say, oh, my goodness.
Could they not speak before they came out with vowel pointing?
Yeah, how did Moshe recite portions of the Torah? How did he write the words down that Yahweh dictated to him, particularly in Bereshith, all of which transpired before his time, if in fact he was writing without vowels? You know, I read the third part of that article on Hebrew being the first alphabet, and there is no other viable
candidate.
And you're dealing with the Hebrews having proven that they had an alphabet, 23-letter alphabet, going back 1,000 years before the next alphabet would appear. And even it was a derivative of Hebrew.
It's a slam dunk to me.
It seems that way. Before we return to Moody Jeff, Moody Jeff is the fellow whose letter and rebuttal that I wrote to him, and then his really very angry reply, is the gentleman that was schooled at the Moody Bible Institute in biblical theology, and took some rather hostile positions with the premise to his questions. And we're going to return to our review of that because of the fact that, and we've done now 3 programs on it, simply because it's very helpful for many who are part of the covenant family.
When we have Christian relatives, too.
Right. We have Christian relatives or friends, and they want to reach out to them and help to answer their questions. So we'll return to that in a moment, but I understand, Kirk, that the Dr. other Jeff, Dr. Jeff, and we actually have 4 or 5 Jeffs in the covenant. That Dr. Jeff, who was the first actually to become part of the covenant as a result of these translations and the commentary on Yahweh's testimony, that Dr. Jeff had a couple of questions. Go ahead.
Well, one of them was one of the things we'd been talking about is, of course, the originality of the Hebrew language being the first one, rather.
Right. Not the first language. The first alphabet. Right. And it's, and by the way, we have to distinguish alphabet from writing systems,
right,
because there is evidence of cuneiform and evidence of hieroglyphics that date to around the same time or slightly before the Hebrew alphabet. But the difference is that in hieroglyphics and in cuneiform, there are many thousands of characters, and the characters can convey entire ideas or names or concepts or things, as opposed to being simply creating the minimal amount of letters necessary to create something that is phonetic, that can be pronounced, which, by the way, means that the 22 letters that comprise the Hebrew alphabet, because it is a phonetic alphabet, that there are vowels, because a alphabet is comprised of closed and open mouth sounds. The closed mouth sounds are considered consonants. The open mouth sounds are considered vowels. But the Hebrew is, by all evidence, 100% of the evidence available to us affirms that Hebrew was the first alphabet. And so it's not the first language, not the first writing system, but the first alphabet. And the an alphabet, most thoughtful scholars will tell you that that an alphabet was man's most important and most difficult invention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't so much as a question, but it was something we were exploring, or he was exploring. He sent all that information. I know you got it all as well, and we've been talking about it and everything. The thing that he really asked about, the two-part question, he said, he's posing, what's the first Nesama, first person who actually has a Nesama? And, of course, I'm sure we're all in agreement that it had to be Adam, and then the second one would have been Chawa, because she had some of the same DNA of Adam in her creation.
Well, that's what we're told, so I'm going to trust you. He was the one that created the concept. He's the one that described the event and told us the components that were used to comprise Adam. And since one of those components was a Nesama, he's the first, correct.
Right. And then the second part of the question was, when was the covenant first revealed? And I'm taking a little liberty, and I think he means in toto or in totality. Was it to Abraham, or did he tell enough of that to, is there any evidence that he told a lot to Adam?
Well, really, every aspect of the covenant is actually conveyed to us through the story with Noach, to be more accurate. It's the hard CH at the end of his name. Also, the O comes from a W in his name. But Noach, if you look at every aspect of that story, of choosing to separate oneself from the human community, choosing to trust and rely on Yahweh, choosing to go in the direction that Yahweh asked him to go, closely examining, carefully considering the relationship directions and guidance that Yahweh had given him, and literally cutting himself off from everyone else. Those really are the terms and conditions of the covenant. And then the sign of the covenant, of the covenant formed with Noach and Yahweh, was the rainbow, which is the seven primary colors, indicating Yahweh's ultimate signature. Seven is the formula and the signature of everything that's important to him. So there we know that we have a covenant. And obviously we know we have a complete and total covenant with all of its terms and conditions presented in toto, including a test to evaluate Abraham's understanding of that covenant with, preceding the Torah by about 550, 600 years. So the question really becomes, did Yahweh depict the terms and conditions of the covenant in his discussions with Adam and with Chawah? And we know we had long discussions with them, that he had a relationship with them and long discussions with them, and things that were important for them to do to maintain the relationship. But we aren't told, because that isn't what is germane of the story of the conditions found in the Garden of Eden.
I would have a hard time believing that in all those discussions, knowing what he knew, and knowing that they would leave him, in fact, that they would choose badly, he would have at least, in telling them, if you eat of this tree, you'll die. This destruction leads there.
You're going to have the tree of the knowledge of good.
It's hard for me not to think that he wouldn't tell how you get back.
It was a tree of knowledge, wasn't it?
Yes.
And a tree of knowledge of good, of those things that were prosperous and beneficial. Isn't the covenant the single most prosperous and beneficial thing that you can know and understand?
If it isn't, I don't know what would be.
Let's make the natural conclusion here, the connection. That's how we come to understand. It was the tree of the knowledge of good, that which is Tob, beneficial, nurturing, progressive, and that which is counterproductive, evil. And so, So there is no way whatsoever that on the depiction of what is good, that Yahweh would have left out that which was ultimately better than anything else. Nor would he have left out from that which is evil, counterproductive, and opposition to Yah, that which would lead people away from the covenant.
Right.
So the moment they took the bite of that apple, they knew the way back.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting that the instructions that Yahweh gave, the judgment that he gave to Adam and Chawah, those were not punishments.
No.
You know, what he told Adam that he's going to work.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, don't you have to engage if you want to be part of the covenant? You need to work work to observe, to know, to understand, to accept, to act upon the terms and conditions of the relationship. And then once you're in the relationship, you need to work at the relationship. And so he told Adam, okay, now you know, you got to work at it, better engage. Mm-hmm. And he told Chawah that, you know, for you, it's going to be about childbirth.
Yeah.
Okay. So, childbirth is the purpose, being born into the covenant family is the purpose of the covenant. So my answer to the question would be the first two people that knew precisely what the terms and conditions of the covenant were and what things would lead away from Yahweh's family were Adam and Chawah.
Yeah.
And then it was reinforced with Noach. You know, Nathan Yahoo that watched the video of our program just a week ago. Yeah, he wanted an answer to a question that was, you know, how did Noach appear upright before Yahweh, right before Yahweh, since he, you know, the implication would be since he lived before the Torah was revealed. Well, the answer to the question then, that question then is answered by our current discussion. If
right.
those individuals who were born with a nefesh and a nesama, well, everyone was born with a nefesh, but with a nesama, descendants of Adam and Chawa, the moment that they came to understand what was good and what was not good, they would have possessed information not only about Yahweh and the relationship that they had enjoyed with him, but how to continue to be engaged in that relationship. And they lived a very long time. They would have communicated it, father to son, through that very short passage of time, considering the average lifetime during that period. And that's how Noach knew who Yahweh was, knew how to be upright in his presence, and answers the question.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were two other things about, if I can go backwards, just one quick
okay.
second.
Sure.
Adam and Chawa, when he comes to find them after they've eaten from the fruit of the tree mm-hmm. of knowledge, what does he do? He slays an animal, bloodshed.
Uh-huh. Right. Covers them.
They probably ate the animal if it was a lamb, but he covers them with some type of material that from the skins.
Right.
Which is all symbolic of being covered for our transgressions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then fast forward a little bit when they have the two sons, Cain and Abel,
yeah.
and they return, they're presenting an offering, or so they're coming to a mikvah, or a mikvah.
Let me speak about the clothing just one moment before we move
okay.
to the second one.
Right.
When Adam and Chawa were in the garden following Yahweh's instructions, and they were immortal, they were perfect. They
right.
appeared perfect in Yahweh's eyes because they were perfect.
Right.
Yahweh uses nakedness as a symbol of our vulnerability, of his ability to see our imperfections. Mm-hmm. When we appear in his presence without the garment of light provided by the set-apart spirit, when we are not cleansed by his light, then we appear naked, as opposed to appearing as light, as brilliant and perfect. You know, so the reason they had to be clothed is at that moment they were imperfect. And for them to be imperfect, either God could not enter their presence, or in their presence, God would have had to have covered them to remedy the
situation. Yeah,
the problem of them now having been corrupted. So that's the reason for the apparel. And yes, you've made the connection. It was now the skin of an animal, and in all likelihood a lamb, to be symbolic of what he was going to do to resolve this problem going mm-hmm. forward.
And then I've always thought that when Cain brought his offering, which was not a lamb,
right. mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
then his brother brings a lamb and is acceptable.
Right.
A way to come back to meet mm-hmm. them.
Mm-hmm.
Then, I mean, that's pretty much the story there, too. I mean, there's all our meetings.
It clearly he would have had to understand Pesach, Passover, at that moment, too.
Sure.
For God would be capricious if he accepted one and found the other unacceptable.
Without
explaining why in advance.
Yeah.
Not just explaining why after the fact, but in advance.
Yeah.
And so it's another just affirmation that they understood these things.
Yeah. So it's always been that way with his children. He's
Correct.
Always told us the information was always there.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Correct. The information we needed to become part of the covenant family preceded our interest in the covenant family, but it was always there for us. God made it available to us. It was our job to seek it out.
Yeah. As a little side note, just before we mm-hmm. go back to Jeff, when you look up Nesama, the word,
yes,
you look up the letters,
yes,
you've got obviously a nun, which is just think for a minute, is children within
right.
and having an inheritance and continuing.
Right. Yeah, drawn as a sperm. Some will call it a root, and root. The root was symbolic back in the day of being rooted in the land of growing of new life of that which is nourishing, mm-hmm. But.
the case, be rooted in the promise too.
Rooted in the promise, rooted in the land. But in the case of this root, roots go down.
Yes.
Roots do not go sideways.
No.
This root goes at a diagonal. It is drawn exactly as we would draw a sperm today.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the letter itself, none, means child.
Yes. So, yeah, that's pretty straightforward.
Pretty straightforward.
Then you follow that with a shin,
right,
which is a nursing word. It could be negative words as well, but in this context is where it is between the nun,
right,
and the mim is
right.
Nursing words would be the best interpretation.
Yeah, in fact, the shin is really interesting. It's drawn to be two teeth. Two upper teeth, as a matter of fact. And the upper teeth are used for cutting.
Yes.
So it's not just, and words emanate from the mouth, so there is, it is often associated with speech and usually associated with speech with words.
You got to chew to get nourishment.
Right. It's also associated with the mouth. That's where we take in food, so it's nourishing from that point of view. But it's the two front teeth, your incisors, and they. Mm-hmm. The idea there is that is what you use to bite into something and separate it, to mm-hmm. pull it away, to cut it apart from other things. You know, they're not the teeth that you use to chew. They're the teeth for separation. And, words are plentiful. It's just like the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There are lots of words there. You know, all those ideas would have been conveyed by words. That's how we think. But not all words are good words. You know, you've got to bite into something and undergo that process of separating that which is good and that which is not good. And so the symbol for the shin carries a lot of additional meaning just beyond teeth and spoken words. Also speaks of cutting and separation. Right.
Sharp, pressure,
right.
Pressing, you know, down all
yeah.
that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So then you follow that with the mim.
Uh-huh.
And what you wind up, and mostly the separation there is cleansing water, and then when that leads us to the set apart spirit, the Ruach Kodesh.
Right, because Ruach Kodesh is always associated with water. Water is the universal solvent.
Oh. So now
it is, water is the place from which life emerged.
Right.
When
the child is born, so yes.
Right. Correct. Water breaks, the child is born. That's why Yosha said you have to be born of water and the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Water is the source of life. If scientists want to search for life on other planets, liquid water is the single most important thing because there just is no chance that life emerged apart from liquid water. Water is also the only compound that we're aware of that actually becomes larger when it becomes colder. You know, it's very interesting that water has these unique properties. If it didn't have these unique properties, there would be no life on this planet. But water is the only thing that is less dense when it gets colder, as opposed to everything else is much more dense when it gets colder.
Yeah.
So water's an interesting compound.
You follow that up, and you've got, but interesting thing on the hay, they're henna originally.
Uh-huh.
I would interpret that as those people who are behold, obviously, to look up and revere something, observe,
right,
and are engaged by walking and standing.
Yeah,
so they're upright. They're upright people.
The nesama, which is our conscience, doesn't do us any good. As a seat of reason, the ability to be judgmental, the ability to think and to understand, which is the nesama,
mm-hmm.
It does not do us any good unless we're observant.
Yes.
If you do not observe, it's just like a computer. You can have the world's fastest operating system, the greatest processor ever conceived, the world's largest hard drive, but if there's no information there to process,
mm-hmm.
none of that will do any good.
No, because
if you
can't have a rational, moral thought, then what do you do with
right.
it? Nothing.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Then you're
so
the same as the animals with a nephesh, or the animal-like human beings. Nobody argues there were 180,000 years of human beings on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
So, So, but they didn't have an Osama. These were rather unique people, and these are the people he obviously gave. I appreciate that. I know Dr. Jeff does.
Yeah, you know, I've always thought that the Yahweh gave man three gifts, but really he did give us more than that. But, you know, the three right at the outset are mortal life, which is our nefesh soul, which gives us the ability to observe and respond to our environments. The only thing that differentiates plants and animals is a nefesh soul. And that soul is definitely mortal. It is not immortal. It is a mortal soul. And then he gave us the nesama. The nesama is the only thing that differentiates humankind from all other animals. It's the ability to reason, to think, to be judgmental, to analyze information and draw reasonable and rational conclusions. And third, he gave us free will. The ability to choose. He is not a lord or a dictator, but instead a father who gives us the opportunity to choose to love him or to ignore him or to reject him or to even be opposed to him. We are given that choice. Now, those are the three fundamental gifts, but the greatest gift of all really is his Torah.
Yes.
That teaching, and the greatest gift of the Torah is the covenant, the ability to take more, to transcend mortal life to immortality, to truncate the degenerative nature of matter and the second law of thermodynamics, and to go from imperfect to perfect, the ability to go from the family of man to the family of Yahweh himself, and then to be enriched and empowered by Yahweh's spirit as his gift to us. And that really follows through the whole process of the first four Moed Mikre, Pesach, Matzah, Bekodim, and Shavuah. So those are really gifts to us beyond just life, mortal life, the nesama, the ability to reason, to think, and free will. I think his Torah, is the with its covenant, is the greatest gift of all. It's the place where God introduces himself to us and gives us the opportunity to engage in a relationship with us, and provides the foundation and perspective, really, to understand our universe and our place in it.
Well, you know, another thought related to our first thing was about the language, the originality of the Hebrew alphabet, in order to put those thoughts together and to have use our free will and our nesama to put all these things together. I can't think of in what I've been studying recently, because I've been doing a massive study on the Amalekites, going back to the Exodus and such and such, which I'll share with you eventually when I get it all my ducks in a row.
But you've also been sharing on the Hebrew alphabet the seven letters that have inclination, the seven letters that were presented either with a left or right profile, the Hebrew, the first letter in the Hebrew alphabet, the Aleph. It is a ram's head that is looking to the left, so it has a left inclination. The shepherd's staff, the lamed, is leaning to the left. Yeah. So the rosh, which is the drawn as a head, it looks to the left. There are letters in Hebrew that have a right and a left inclination, and there's seven that are that move in one direction or the other, and that they actually help define whether a word should be, and the symbols, because the symbols themselves aren't necessarily good or bad.
No,
the symbols can be are just represent sounds for the most part, but also ideas. But there are good families and bad families, good people and bad people. Good words and bad words.
You to be the most evil thing on the planet, or it allows you to be the best thing on the planet.
Correct. Right, and it's by the
world can get you destroyed. The Earth doesn't really usually destroy itself. I mean, other than asteroid, like it doesn't.
Right.
Animals don't go around killing each other to exterminate the herd.
Yeah, and one of the most interesting is the Rosh, since it is so clearly looking to the left. If the Rosh is followed by reading right to left, if it's followed by one of the letters in Yahweh's name, a Yod, for example, then it almost always has a positive connotation. Right. But if it's facing away from a yod or a hey or a wa, it almost always has a negative connotation.
Mm-hmm. So it's this walking away from yah or going to yah.
Right.
In a nutshell, I mean, it's more than that, but that was the conclusion I kind of came to, so it was really interesting. What a fabulous language.
Yes.
I mean, gosh, what a...
Yeah, there's so much, in fact, that'll get us into the first word here of Moody Jeff's letter. One of the things that I think is the most fun about the language of Hebrew is that it has characteristics that are found in no other languages, and characteristics that just make it much more effective to communicate the relationship that Yah intended to create with us. For example, Yahweh says that his word represents him. He says that he is light, and he says that his Torah is light. Therefore, Yahweh equals Torah. For his words in his Torah to represent him, then they have to be eternal just as he is eternal. Now, this is a problem. You know, Christians always think of God as being eternal, and then they show up with their two big holidays, baby God and dead God. Baby God is not eternal, and dead God is not eternal. So, it's just part of the hypocrisy of Christianity.
Or the lack of understanding what Yahusha was.
Right, yes. Baby God and dead God. I'm sorry. No, God was never a baby, and God never died. But the fact is that Hebrew is one of the only languages, maybe the only language, where verbs are not stuck in time.
There is no Hayo, isn't they? Which we can say because they're...
Right. They're all Hayah. They exist. They exist in time. That's why Yahweh based his name on the verb Hayah. They simply exist in time. They just like he was, he is, he will be, the words of the Torah were, are, and will be. Mm-hmm. So that's fascinating. The fact that virtually every Hebrew verb was written with a stem, and the stems always depict a relationship between the subject and the object. And so they define the very nature of the action between the party speaking and the party being spoken to, or the party being spoken about. And then the fact that virtually all of the moods in Hebrew are volitional. So they convey free will from the perspective of the speaker, or second or third person. So it's just it's a phenomenal language to convey the covenant and as a relationship. Yeah, well, as an eternal relationship with an eternal God. So it's beyond the fact that it was the original language from a phonetic alphabet point of view. It's way beyond the fact that it's relational stems and volitional moods and infinite verbs. They also have two conjugations, one of which is ongoing, the other one is complete, which is just so essential with God providing instructions to us. You know, for example, the 10 statements etched in stone, when he gets down to the 7 instructions, they're all written in the imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
So if they weren't written in the imperfect, they would be, it might as well, might as well just say give up. But
yeah,
because they're written, right? It doesn't say that you can't ever deceive. It doesn't say you can't ever kill. It doesn't say that you can't ever commit an act of adultery. It doesn't say that you can't ever ignore the special nature of the Shabbat. No, it says don't make a practice of it. Don't make a habit of killing. Don't kill on an ongoing basis. Don't lie on an ongoing basis. You know, don't. These things were all written in the imperfect. So it's another wonderful aspect of the Hebrew language that makes it the perfect conveyor of Yahweh's intent. And when we try to interpret God through other languages, like English, and you know, we can use English, it's just that we have to convey English from the Hebrew perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But those that try to view God from Greek, you can't get there.
No, and then you compound it with 600,000 to 700,000 words in English, and then a guy with an Nesama who doesn't like Yahweh, he's going to twist it even more.
Correct.
As otherwise, why do we have 350,000 New Testament changes?
Yeah.
Over 180,000 words.
Let me give you the single worst. It's not one that Moody Jeff brought up, but it's the single worst. Church.
Yes.
Church. I mean, how many buildings are there in the world called a church? How many organizations are there called a church? Hundreds of thousands? Millions?
Mm-hmm.
Millions, probably. If you took the number of organizations referring to themselves as church and the number of buildings of people referring to that building as a church, it's probably in the millions.
Yes.
And Christians will speak of God establishing his church. It's the church of God. It's the house of God. Did God ever speak of anything even remotely akin to a church?
No.
Did he ever speak the word church?
No, sir.
What language did Yahusha speak?
Hebrew.
Hebrew. And what language is the Christian New Testament, the oldest extant copies, what language is it written in?
It's all written in Greek.
Greek, okay. Koine Greek. So the Christian New Testament, when it's quoting Yahusha, by the way, there is no Jesus. The J wasn't even invented until the 17th century.
Yeah, 1700 years.
Yeah, 17th century, so there's no Jesus. And the ous is to make the name comply to Greek grammar rules. It had no bearing whatsoever on a Hebrew name. His name was Yahusha. When Yahusha spoke Hebrew, and that in his sentence was translated 100, 200, or 300 years after he spoke it into Greek, what was the Greek word used to translate what he actually said?
Are you talking about the New Angelion? I mean, no.
For the word that has been changed to church.
Oh, the Mikra.
No. Well, that's what he said in Hebrew. The Greek word is ecclesia.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
That's the Greek word. It's ecclesia.
Yes, I know that. Sorry.
Yeah, ecclesia.
Oh, brain.
Right. Okay, ecclesia. Is it possible to transliterate, which means to replicate the sound of ecclesia to church?
No.
No. Church is a transliteration, replicates the sound of Shersh, who is the goddess daughter of Helios, the sun god, the supreme god of the Teutonic and Germanic tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the basis of circle, which is the sun image. It's the basis of circus. It's the basis of circuit. All of those are from the same name of the same goddess.
Yeah.
Right. No correlation whatsoever between the goddess and the word that Yahusha was translated saying. Ekklesia, ek means out in Greek. Klesia is to call.
So
what is it? If you want to translate ekklesia, it would be called out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is there, what is the Hebrew word? And there's really only one Hebrew word as a verb means to call out. There's only one Hebrew verb that means to call out, kara. So if he said a verb, it would be kara.
Mm-hmm.
There is one noun that is based on kara that literally sits at the very fulcrum, the very purpose of Yahusha's life.
Excuse me. I'm sorry, I coughed. I beg your pardon.
Kara is the verb to call out, but ecclesia is used as a noun.
Right.
Okay. There is one noun in the Hebrew language that is based on kara. What is that one noun?
The mikra?
That's right, mikra. Mikra is the mikra and mikre in the plural.
Oh, mikre, plural.
Yeah, mikre is the plural. Mikra is the singular. Mikra is based entirely on the, and it's the only noun, based on the Hebrew verb to call out.
Right.
So if you have the Greek word ekklesia, call out, used as a noun, It is translating the only Hebrew noun based on the concept to call out. Mikra. Now, does Yahweh use the term mikra and in plural mikre in any conversation that's important? That might somehow fit Yosha saying, upon this rock I will build my mikra. Yeah, why would he use that term, mikra? Was there anything that Yahweh had to say about the mikra? Is this an important noun somehow?
Well, this is when we're going to meet 7 times a year, and we're called to meet on these occasions.
They are the very annual meetings that enable the five benefits of the covenant, which we talked about: Pesach, eternal life, matzah, perfection, bakudim, to be born as a child into Yahweh's family, Shavuah, to be enriched and empowered as children of God. The first four mikre actually enable all five benefits of the covenant. How many mikre did Yosha fulfill before he went to see the father and left us for good?
Well, with the help of the Ruach Kodesh, four.
Yep.
We have three more to go, but in time, in elements of thinking in terms of time.
Realistically, he didn't fulfill any one of the four without the help of the Ruach Kodesh, he could not have been the Passover lamb had the Ruach Kodesh not separated herself from him. Pesach could not have happened, and matzah is all about the reunion the ultimate after he's separated from the Ruach Kodesh and then is reunified with the Ruach Kodesh. And of course, Bukudim is the firstborn child literally emerging into the light by way of the set apart spirit. And you're correct. Shavuah was fulfilled entirely by the set apart spirit. Mm-hmm. So, you don't really have to know the whole story of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, of Yahweh, of the covenant, to be able just to do this analysis we just did, that if you look up the basis for church, you'll find that there's no connection whatsoever between church and ecclesia, and that's the Greek word that Yosha was translated as saying. And all you have to do is look at what is the Hebrew word that is closest to ecclesia as a noun, and there's only one, mikra. And then you realize that mikra is literally the purpose of his life. It was what he was going immediately to fulfill, and everything he was doing and saying was building towards that event. And so by changing ecclesia to church, as opposed to properly conveying it as mikra,
you've led them to a pagan tradition.
The single most important thing, the single most important thing that Yosha may have ever conveyed was not just lost, not just squandered, but was taken to paganism. That is how serious it is when we don't use the right words, when we don't understand the words. You know, the tree. We go right back to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. All ideas, good or bad, are conveyed by words.
Right.
We understand in words. We come to know through words. We think in words. And when we do not use words properly, then we render our nesama, our ability to think, inoperative.
Mm-hmm. And that's the definition of Babel.
Correct. Yeah, to confuse, to intermix. And Babel doesn't just mean to confuse, it means to intermix. And so here, a profound truth, building upon the mikre, these seven invitations to meet with God, that Yosha was observing himself and fulfilling himself, enabling the benefits himself, that we take that profound truth and we mix it in with the pagan lore of church and churches, and that's how you get a gazillion people are confused. I remember when I had the carpet layers here in this home in Ohio, and I was talking about how, you know, all religions are corrupt, and talking about it was condemnation of the Roman Catholic Church, and Daniel says, you know, you are not going to criticize my church. And, you know, he was the one, Jesus said, you know, upon this rock I will build my church. It's his church and my church, and you won't criticize it. No, I'm sorry, but that's not what he said. And he most certainly does not have a church. And to believe that, you have been played for a fool. But this exercise we would just want to under. Now, I understand that it would take some time, because if you read your King James or some other English translation, they do not translate the Hebrew. They really don't. There is no attempt to convey the meaning of Kara, the base of Mikre, to come up with a accurate and complete definition as invitations to be called out and meet. That is a complete and accurate translation of Mikre. They make no attempt to do that. They render it convocation, so...
Another religious tone.
Yeah. So I understand it takes some work. That's why the instruction given, the sentence given to Adam was, you're going to work.
Yeah.
You're going to work. You're going to work. You've got to work at it. You've got to want to work at it. So now, rather than work at it, here is Moody Jeff, and he is casting aspersions. He says, why do you point out the term gospel as so egregious? It seems that you are correct that it came from God spelled. That's not what I said, and we'll deal with that in a second. But most Christians associate the word with what seems to be the original intent, good news.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's begin. Okay. When you create a word, or you apply a word in what you claim is a translation, you are misleading people. First of all, we'll just go back over this again. Did Yosha speak Greek or Hebrew?
He spoke Hebrew.
He spoke Hebrew, okay.
And
the oldest eyewitness accounts we have, the oldest accounts that we have of his life are actually in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, but the oldest eyewitness accounts we have may well have been written in Hebrew originally. It's certainly Matanyah was written in Hebrew.
Probably would, yeah.
Yeah, well, we have so much evidence that Matanyah was written in Hebrew, we just don't have an extant Hebrew copy. So somebody, whether it was 100 years later, 200, 300, took the Hebrew and translated it into Greek. What is the Greek term that appears in the Greek that has been rendered gospel?
It's the good news to know.
Euangelion. Euangelion is the Greek.
It's the Greek one, yes.
Yeah. Do you know what euangelion is based on? It's like ecclesia in that it's a compound word. You and agelos are the two words that are combined to create euangelion. You know what you means in Greek?
Not sure. No.
It's identical to the Hebrew word tob.
Oh, good. Well, good. Beneficial.
Yeah,
message.
Beneficial. Yeah, healthy, nurturing, supportive, advantageous. Good. So yeah. Tob is what he would have said is tob. But for example, Yahweh says the Torah is tob. Good, advantageous. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, good is tob. Agelos is the second part of the compound word. Do you know what agelos means in Greek?
Well, messenger, they're changing angel to malak, malaki, or a malak, rather, a uh-huh. angel, wait, messenger.
Right, right. Yeah, it's primary word, yeah, it's the Hebrew word. There's only one Hebrew word. Just like you in Hebrew is tob, mm-hmm. and agelos in Hebrew is malak. Agelos in Greek is malak in Hebrew, and malak is messenger.
Yeah.
The primary meaning of agelos is messenger. The secondary meaning of agelos is message. So. Euangelion would be a translation of what Yosha said would be Tob Malak.
Mm-hmm.
And Tobin Lockwood speaks of the beneficial messenger.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically, a beneficial and good spiritual messenger. All right. So that's the meaning of it. And that's what it would have been in Hebrew. Euangelion. How do you get from euangelion to gospel?
You can't.
Well, a leap.
All the way to Germany.
Leap suggests it's just like you can't get from ecclesia to church. There's no leap that gets you there.
Let me interrupt one quick second.
Okay.
I'm sitting here looking at Strong's, and I looked up church, and there's no reference to church in anywhere in the Torah. All they have is a translation.
Of course.
Wouldn't they give you a clue?
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
There was no church, so.
Yeah, and if they had actually translated ecclesia
then they would
as to call out, they would then, if they were doing their job, would be to say, relates to the Hebrew verb kara and as a noun, mikra.
Yeah.
It's straightforward. It's straightforward. But you've got to think to get there. Mm-hmm. But you can't get from euangelion to gospel.
No.
Gospel, you look up in any historical text. It is not God's spell. It's Gott's spell. Gott was the name of the Germanic god. In fact, Gott is still the name of God in Germanic languages.
Right.
It wasn't
put spells on people.
Right. Yes. So this was Gott's spell, not God's spell, and God does not cast spells. So it's a pagan god casting spells. And if you look up spell in any early English dictionary, it would be just like you would think of a demon.
Yeah, like a fairy tale.
Yeah, well, a spell, yeah.
To
that's right, exactly. They're very negative connotations with the word. You can't get from one to the other. So to pretend that God created this term and it's an appropriate term, God's spell, and to ignore what he actually says, which would be Tob Malak, is just criminal.
Mm-hmm.
You can't understand if you don't know, and if you corrupt the terminology, you can't know. That's why I care about this stuff.
Yeah.
The fact that
don't change a John the Tittle, much less
right,
the words.
Right. So the fact that Christians view it as good news, then that's how they ought to have translated it, even though good news would not have been as complete, because Tob means a lot more than good, and agelos is actually messenger and only secondarily message.
Message, yeah,
right. And the Hebrew word that would have been used for agelos would absolutely have been malak, and in the case of malak, it is messenger, not message.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're talking about the individual.
Yes.
We're talking about the individual. We're talking about Yosha. We're talking about the set-apart spirit. We're talking about the implements that Yahweh uses to convey his will and intent in our world. And you lose all of that when you change the words. Another great one in terms of absolutely rendering those affected by it stupid, dumbfounded, perplexed, is holy.
Yeah.
It is a corruption of a religious corruption of perhaps one of the two or three most important concepts conveyed by God. It is the Hebrew word that holy replaces is kodesh.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this in a prior program. Everything that's important to Yahweh is kodesh. He is kodesh, set apart.
Right.
His Torah is kodesh, set apart. His covenant is kodesh, set apart. His Shabbat is kodesh, set apart. Yosha is the most set apart. Kodesh, Kodesh. The spirit is the set apart spirit. And once you understand the concept of set apart, of being part of something and set apart from that something, or being set apart from something to be part of another, whichever way you're coming from God. For example, the most set apart and the set apart spirit cannot be separate personas when you understand the concept of set apart. They're part of Yahweh, set apart from him. Right. So Yosha and the set apart spirit are part of Yahweh, set apart from him, not separate personas. There's no Trinity. And then when you understand why everything important to Yahweh is set apart, including Yisrael and his everything associated with his family and his home, that means you have to think, set apart from what?
Yeah.
From man. From the human, right, exactly. And so all of that is lost with the change to holy. And if you don't know the words, if you don't know the terminology, then you're rendered incapable of knowing what God is saying. Another spectacular one is Jesus.
Yeah.
Now, there is no basis for it whatsoever. None. Not in the, first of all, he did not have a Greek name. He was not Greek. Second of all, it wasn't written Jesus in Greek. It was written Iusu, Iusu, Iusun. However, in 100% of the 69 extant, that means that which we have found, codexes, manuscripts, fragments and entire books from the so-called Christian New Testament, in 100% of them, 100% of the time, on every manuscript prior to around 375 CE, late 4th century, there isn't a single manuscript where Iusu, Iusus, or Iusun was written out. Not one ever. Instead, placeholders were used, just as they were used in the Septuagint. And the placeholders represented the Hebrew names, because the Hebrew names could not be transliterated into Greek, and the Hebrew names had meaning in Hebrew, and they had no meaning whatsoever in Greek. There is no basis whatsoever for Jesus, has no relationship to God, isn't God's name, isn't the English name for God, isn't the English name for the person who lived long ago. The name is Yosha. Jesus means squat. The closest transliteration from which Jesus emerged is Jesus with a G, pronounced the same way, Jesus. Jesus was the Jesus was the savior in the Druid religion, where the horned one was God.
Yeah.
Not good.
If you want that Jesus, go ahead.
You can have him.
Yeah.
Your precious Jesus is a pagan god. His name was Yosha, and if you don't know his name, you do not know him. Yosha is a mission statement, and it discloses his identity. Means Yahweh saves. So that's why these names are critically important, why these words are critically important, and when they're changed, you lose all hope of understanding. And if you're going to fight them, as Moody Jeff is doing here, you know, you're going to say, wait a minute, you make a big deal out of this, but, you know.
It is a big deal.
But, you know, it's just, this is what they think it means this, so, you know, why is that a big deal? This is, you know, he would even go on to say, just doesn't seem to be a strong case for condemning Christianity. The hell it isn't.
No, I'm not laughing.
Well, for example, let's take Christianity.
Yeah.
Did Yosha ever say any word that was translated Christian?
No.
Did he ever say any word that was translated Christianity?
No, they invented that. That's the Christo.
No, actually, you know how Christianity became? It's written in Acts.
Yeah.
And it's only written in Acts. So Luke was Paul's attaché there for a while. And in Acts, he says they were called. And he actually said Christianios for the first time, not Christians, and they're entirely different words. We'll be back this evening and again next week.